Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you. We're going to get started with our lunchtime keynote. I'm Tim Arcuri. I'm the semiconductor and semi-equipment analyst here at Cowen, and we're very pleased to have Applied Materials, to have Bob Halliday, who's the CFO of Applied. We're very pleased to have him for our lunch keynote. So I'm going to ask a few questions, and then we can open it up to the audience, and we'll go from there. So first question for me, Bob. I want to just go right at some of the issues recently about the merger. There's been some articles published, and there's been some speculation about closure of the merger, potential delays in the merger. So maybe can you just sort of attack that head-on and just talk about the status of the merger, whether from a timing perspective things remain on track, whether we're thinking Q3, maybe into Q4, just what your expectations are there?
Sure. Let me see if I can calibrate the audience for what's going on. So Applied Materials is the biggest process equipment, semiconductor capital equipment company in the world, and one of the second or third biggest is Tokyo Electron, a company in Japan. So we announced last September we're going to merge the companies. Just in terms of the rationale of the deal I think makes sense for our customers, for the two combined companies, and sort of for the industry. If you look at our industry, there was no real mergers for years. In the last few years, there's been several. There's Varian and Applied Materials, Lam, Novellus, and also ASML and Cymer, and now we've announced Applied Materials and TEL. The reason it makes sense for the industry is if you look at the challenges of our customers, I'm going to answer your question, Tim. The challenges are tougher. The technology challenges are much more difficult, particularly on things like vertical devices, FinFETs and V-NANDs. The production ramps, believe it or not, are three times as steep as they used to be, because instead of ramping a node over 2 years, they might ramp it in one-third that time because they need, you know, 20 million iPhones or Samsung Galaxies at Christmas, right? So the production ramps are steeper, and the field support issues are more complex. So having big, capable suppliers, like putting together Applied Materials and Tokyo Electron to support the technology challenges, the production ramps, and the support, makes a lot of sense for the industry and the customer base. So that's why it makes sense for the industry. For Applied Materials and Tokyo Electron, it makes a lot of sense from that perspective. And two, as I think you've seen in our models, from an investor perspective, makes a lot of sense in terms of scaling the economics and providing benefits and cash flow to investors. In terms of Tim's specific question, we announced the deal last September, and pretty consistently since last September we've said we expect approval, we expect it in the second half of calendar 14, and we're going through the process. We still believe that is the case. We believe that if you look at antitrust considerations, it tends to be really around head-to-head competition. And if you look at head-to-head competition between Tokyo Electron and Applied Materials, it virtually does not exist. I can't think of a time when we both bid on the same business, right? So I think in a classic antitrust perspective of head-to-head competition, we don't see overlaps. And all the lawyers, consultants, experts we have had have agreed with us. So we continue to believe the deal will be approved. We continue to believe it'll be the second half of the year. Now, tactically, just tactics, it just may take a little bit longer, just to get it done. For instance, we had to translate, I don't know, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of pages of documents from Japanese to English and provide that to the authorities. So just the mechanics of doing this, including in a country like China where, you know, the resources are not quite as big as U.S. to review these deals, we think we're going to be okay. Just might be sort of the second half of the second half.
Do you think possibly, as you know, China being one region, one key important region that you need to get approval for MOFCOM, do you think that you could get caught up in this China-U.S. War that's sort of breaking out? Do you think that, you know, you could possibly be a pawn that the government could use to potentially delay the merger?
Well, a couple of things. One, it's sort of above my pay grade to figure that one out, number one. Number two, you know, most of the review process is a legal review process. In other words, what's the law on antitrust, and do you fall within the boundaries of the law? And we think within that we're fine. Whether there's some other nationalistic consideration. It's hard for me to judge that.
Okay. Maybe just ask a question, also on cost savings around the merger. You've put out a number that you can save $500 million per year, ultimately, from the deal. It seems if you benchmark that against some of the other deals, and we have talked about this before, some of the other deals and semis, that seems to be a relatively low number, and it seems like you could do better than that. If you take that $500 million and if you segment that out, is that mostly OPEX savings? Is that outright elimination of particular businesses? So maybe two questions. One, can you break that out? In other words, how are you going to get that $500 million? And two, is it reasonable to assume that that is a very conservative number, because it appears to be conservative relative to what some other companies have already saved?
Yeah, so if you look at the opportunity set, in the model we put forth for 2017, that was a $37 billion wafer fab equipment environment, and we would have $18.2 billion of revenue that year. And in that, we did not include the components business of Tokyo Electron, which they hold an equity investment in, and we did not include the solar business, which is pretty small. So that $18 billion has 25% operating margins. So 75% of the 18.2 is the opportunity set for cost reduction. So it's about $14 billion. So we'd have to get $500 million out of $14 billion in 2017. So that includes operating expenses, material costs, everything, buildings, facilities, corporate costs, you name it. I think the 500 is pretty doable. We said we'd do $500 million in 2017. So I agree with Tim that the opportunity set is pretty darn good. I think the opportunity set, 500 is a good estimate for 2017. Some of this is cumulative and iterative over time. For instance, if you look at our products, 85% of the cost to build a product is material cost. You will continue to iterate material cost savings between the two companies over time. Some of that iteration will be common platforms, common parts. You'll keep getting more and more of that every year. So the question is, do we get more or less than $500 million in 2017? I agree with Tim that the opportunity set is pretty robust. It might end up being more than 500. I think 500 in 2017 is a reasonable estimate.
Okay. Another thing that, when I speak to people about the merger and about the stock, they say, well, that's great, and, you know, it all sounds fabulous, but the perception is that it relies on the overall market to grow to a $37 billion WFE number, because that's what the slide said, right? And it seems to me that actually you're sizing the business to be much more profitable even if WFE doesn't grow.
Right.
So can you talk a little bit about sort of how you think about what the right WFE level is that you should size the business to be as profitable as you target at? Does it require WFE to grow to $37 billion, or do you think that the company can be significantly more profitable than it is today even at current business levels?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'll repeat, I think I mentioned this to Tim earlier in the day. When I first joined Applied Materials as CFO about 14 months ago, I asked two questions to people in the company. I said, hey, are we a pretty big company? And everybody said, yeah, well, you know, $8, $9 billion even in a so-so year. And I said, do you think we have really good products and strong IP? They said, yeah, we got great products, great IP. So I said, well, a company with really strong IP, great products, and pretty big company, shouldn't you be north of 20% operating margins almost no matter what in a mediocre wafer fab equipment year? I said, I guess so. So we weren't hitting that. So our model is, if you go to our analyst day last July, it was on the website, I don't know if it's still there, we put up four models. But the two models we focused on were a $30 billion wafer fab equipment model and a 37. The 37, we said we'd make 25, 26% operating margin. But even at the $30 billion model for Applied Materials, we said we're going to have 22.5% operating margins. My point is, the way we manage the combined company, Applied and with Tokyo Electron, is we need to get north of 20% operating margins, even in an okay spending environment. Because that's the type of model we should run to. With our IP and our scale, we should achieve that even in an okay year. And if we achieve that, the $37 billion model is easy. So what you don't want to do is size your company, especially in a semi-cyclical business, for the peak year. You'll never make any money cross-cycle. You never make any cash cross-cycle. So what we're running the combined company to is a medium year, $30 billion. Because if we can do north of 20% and $30 billion, the $37 billion environment's easy. And we'll make a lot more money cross the cycle.
Great. Can you talk just a little bit about the near-term business? You had talked about on the call the fact that recently there's been some more signs that timing on FinFET has firmed up, and some customers were going to start to potentially come back to build out volume for FinFET, possibly even later on this year. Can you just talk a little bit about near-term business environment, particularly as it relates to FinFET timing? There's a bunch of these transistor architectures out there, and timing is difficult to predict, but it sounds like the gears are sort of catching on FinFET now.
Yeah, let me give you a little perspective and get into your question. So if I'd been doing this conference back in, I don't know, January, the three things that would have been relevant to understanding spending this year were, one, and it's still true today, you have to look below the top three spenders. You have to look below Samsung, Intel, and TSMC. So you've got to look at the next five, people like Hynix, GlobalFoundries, Micron, UMC, and Toshiba. Because the top three spending is probably flattish. For the next five, I think, are virtually all spending more money this year, and I'll come to why. The second thing you would have had to understand back in January and today is two big technology inflections. One is V-NAND, where they're going to make NAND devices vertically, stack them up like an apartment building, 24, 32, 64 layers, one on top of each other, and those are enabling technology, okay? The second big technology inflection this year is FinFETs, where FinFETs, instead of a planar flat device, they're actually going to go vertical like a fin on a fish. That's why they're called FinFETs, right? Those are big inflections. Those two things together add incremental spending this year. The next five guys building out and this technology, these two technology transitions. The third thing that was relevant for this year, earlier in the year, people said you're going to have a big air pocket the middle of the year because 20 nanometer device build out, not that big, and there's going to be a hole getting to FinFETs, right? So people are starting to feel better. There isn't a big gap in the middle of the year for a couple of reasons. One, the next five guys are spending, and the FinFET stuff's looking more real. So if you talk to me at the beginning of the year, V-NAND came into the year, 30,000 wafer starts installed at the beginning of the year. We thought it could get up to 100, 130 by the end of the year. Now we think it's about 80,000, incremental 50, so a little less. But NAND spending in total is still pretty darn healthy this year, up, okay? The second thing is FinFET stuff, even in the last month or so, we're getting significant pull for that. So why are you going to get pull? So if everybody in the room looks in their pocket, they've got a cell phone, right, or a smartphone. Smartphones need two things. They need pretty fast processing power, and they need the battery to last, so just like your tablet. So FinFETs are really good for processor power and battery life because contact resistance, leakage are better. So there is a big battle to get to FinFETs first. FinFETs are very powerful in two considerations. One, really powerful devices to enable next generation phones and tablets. Two, whoever gets there first probably will gain market share, right? There's a good chance. That's what they believe. So the technology and the competitive dynamics are driving them to go forward on FinFETs aggressively. So what we see is pilot production ramps for FinFETs getting pulled in by several customers. And if those go well, we think they would aggressively ramp production. Now, until you get through pilot, you don't quite see it. So the fourth calendar quarter, you don't know yet. But we're, from the beginning of the year, a little more cautious on V-NAND, although NAND generally is pretty good, but a little more optimistic on the outlook for FinFET.
Okay. And then also on DRAM, there's been some recent comments out of customers that have said that, well, when you shrink down from 25 nanometer down to 20, that actually there's a net capacity reduction, a net wafer capacity reduction of some say 20%, some say 40%.
This is on the
DRAM shrink.
DRAM.
And so DRAM seems to be a placeholder that everyone just seems to have flatlined at 3 to 3.5 billion WFE. And it seems like that could be an area where people are missing some potential upside, because if there's a net wafer capacity reduction between 20 and 40%, then we might have to spend some more money in DRAM and not really add any new wafer capacity, but yet have to spend more money.
You're saying because of die size?
Yes, and because of the architecture of the shrink. So in DRAM, do you think that DRAM represents a potential upside driver to the spending environment over the next year or two?
So watch the dynamic in the front room. The last few questions, Tim asked me a question in 30 seconds. I answer in 8 minutes, right? So this time he says, okay. He says, oh, boy, I get to ask a question again. So I'll give you the short answer, yes. Now I'll give you the 8-minute answer, right, which is, so you got to segment the market. DRAM historically has been heavily used in PCs. Microsoft comes out with a new operating system. Everybody needs a bigger PC. Load some DRAM into the PC, right? If you go look, you know, PC sales are not heroic in the last few years, but mobile devices have grown a lot. And if you go look, about every 18 months, they double the amount of DRAM in the phones, and phones and tablets are still going through the roof, right? So about a year ago, I think it was about a year ago, we reached an inflection point where the DRAM capacity absorption for mobile exceeded PCs. And that trend line continues up, so the mix in demand between mobile and PCs is changing. And the one that's driving the bus a little bit more now is mobile, because it's starting to suck more and more DRAM. So I think, one, DRAM segmentation of demand is optimistic. Second thing is, DRAM chip, if you want to make your own DRAM chips at home, you got the cell and you got the periphery, right? So the periphery is logic-like. So if you go look at the transitions that logic chips went through 6 years ago, they started to get at things that are more capital-intensive, patterning, more steps. So DRAM is going to get more capital-intensive like everything else. So between mobile devices driving some more incremental demand to more capital intensity to make these new devices at the next node, and a little bit, three, you know, they had excess capacity from all the way back in 08 that they've used up finally. Those things make me a little more optimistic on DRAM. So if you ask me from the beginning of the year when you invited me to this conference January 1st to today, I'm probably incrementally positive on DRAM, and foundry's pretty good. A little bit more conservative on NAND and logic.
Got it. Thanks for that. One more question for me, and then we'll open up to the audience. But last year at SemiCon West, you provided us with an updated financial model, and you know this year you have the shareholder vote on the merger on June 23rd. So it's possibly a bit tight, between that time and SemiCon. But what should we expect to hear from the company at SemiCon? Do you think that we should expect an updated financial model or any updated commentary around a merger?
Yeah, I think, so we're going to have an investor day the first day of SemiCon in the afternoon, so everyone's invited. And then at the end of that, we're going to have a separate meeting for an hour with Tokyo Electron. So I think what we presented last year at our analyst day in July and when we announced the merger in the end of September, those models are still highly credible, and we believe in those models. And I think they're attractive financial models. I think we will. The medium's the message. I think we can give more and more credibility to people and more comfort that, A, we will hit the financial models, and, B, the merger is going to happen. So I think if people feel that the financial models are incrementally more credible than a year ago and incrementally the deal is going to happen, that sense of comfort is more powerful, frankly, than fiddling with the financial model, because I think the financial model is still very valid and we'll achieve it, right? So the tone and reinforcement of what we said in the past, I think, is powerful rather than, I don't think there's any fine-tuning necessary on sort of the 2017 model. The single biggest question we tend to get on the model is, gee whiz, I don't know if $37 billion is the right wafer fab equipment number in 2017. And our response to that for forever is, who knows, it's in the ballpark, it's what Jadakiss says, but we're running the company at $30 billion. We'll make money at $30 billion, right? So I think at Analyst Day, we'll give people increasing comfort that we will hit our targets, increasing comfort about the merger, increasing comfort when you see us together, the team's working well together, and this team will be able to execute the merger.
Great, thanks for that. Let's open it up to the audience.
I don't hear any forks and knives, so you've stopped eating. In the back.
With regard to the merger, but there's been some stories that there have been major corporations such as Intel, perhaps, lodging complaints. Anything that you can help us to understand that is either not true or not, in your view, going to be an impediment?
Well, first let me assuage your fears that I'm confident and not paranoid. I'm paranoid and worry about everything. So, number one. Number two, you know, we, even over this weekend, even yesterday, we were pinging all the lawyers, all the consultants, all the advisors, and they continue to advise us that the merger will continue to happen. They don't see any legal grounds for problem. So all the advice we get is steady as you go. We think it'll happen.
And the delay is, you mentioned earlier, because of translations, things of that nature?
It's logistical, right? In other words, it's hard to predict. If you go in the U.S., there's a pretty fine timeline. If you go in the U.S., it's like, turn in the documents, 30 days later we give you feedback, 60 days. It's a pretty defined timeline. The timeline and resources are not as discrete in China, right? So it's under, you know, it could close sooner or later. I don't know.
But it's not because you've gotten any pushback.
No, we're still providing documents as much as anything, right?
Thank you.
Hi, is there something incongruous between your statement that the industry will continue to grow and the top five, or the second tier will continue to spend? Because right before your presentation today, for instance, some of those companies were presenting across the street, and they were talking about the newfound discipline they have on return on invested capital, and they're not going to, that the industry, there's a paradigm shift in the industry, and they're going to be much more careful about adding capacity.
Yeah, I don't know if they're inconsistent. I mean, if you go look at the spending projections for the next five, they're pretty healthy. If you look at overall DRAM spending, it's probably up this year. It's not up a huge amount. I think they're still being judicious, frankly. I think where you see potentially a little more aggressive spending is more around the FinFET battle. I think people like GlobalFoundries and Samsung see that it's an enabling technology, so they want to get the pilot lines ramped up. So I think it's balanced. NAND is up this year, but it's not off the charts.
Just on that point, Bob, so if you graph industry wafer capacity, and if you graph that against IC units, which are somehow somewhat representative of the demand for capacity, there's a pretty big gap that's developing because wafer capacity is not growing, much to the prior question, because the customers are being very judicious about not wanting to spend the money. Yet demand keeps on growing. So somehow this equation has to break, because either if demand is going to continue and if capacity is going to keep on tightening, something is going to happen. Either prices are going to go up or the companies are going to have to start to spend money again. So as you sort of look at the situation that's developing, how do you think the whole thing shakes out? Because you sound equally optimistic about spending the next 2 years as I am. And yet, you know, you listen to the companies, and I have these half-hour conversations with investors every day about, well, you know, you're saying this, but the companies are saying this. So can you just talk about the particular drivers that make you so optimistic about the next 2 years, even in light of the prior question that the companies don't seem to want to add new wafer capacity?
Yeah, a couple of things. One, again, you have to segment the markets, right? So if you look at memory, DRAM and NAND, I think they're both up this year, but they weren't super high bases. I mean, if you go back and look at some of the early years, they were much higher back in 08, 07, stuff like that. And then some of what they're doing is retrofitting some facilities like Elpida, right? So they're judicious. So I think they're being judicious. I'm not throwing it to the rocks. But they're up. I mean, you go look at the data, the spending's up, right? DRAM and NAND. And still, they're being very judicious. So I think if supply and demand, if demand keeps increasing, you go look at the mobile data. So there's three things that'll drive it, right? One is demand for those sales units up? Yeah. Two, what's die size doing? It's moderate. Three, capital intensity is sort of up. And four, they've used off some old capacity. Those things and their spending tend to be up some. Now, I'm not saying they're being non-judicious. I think it's up some. I think you have a somewhat different issue in foundry. If you go look at spending for several years now, including this year, it's very healthy by people like TSMC and a couple of years ago, Samsung. If you look at GlobalFoundries, I think they're being healthy spenders this year. I think UMC's up this year, too. So the data out there is they're going to spend more. And those folks have capital intensity issues going up somewhat. And they see a lot of pull for those end devices, especially around FinFET. So there's a competitive issue and a demand issue, which are pretty positive. Logic is, you know, Intel's maintaining their spending forecast, and, you know, it's a hard one to predict. Now, as a practical matter, Intel doesn't add a lot of capacity, more technology buys and stuff like that, so they're not as big in our mix. But if you go look at the spending forecast by customer, by device, and you look at where they're coming from, and, you know, this year we thought it was $32 billion, maybe it's $31.6, $31.5. It's healthy, but it's not off the charts.
Does just one thing that seems to be happening is that the increases in capital intensity are making the big downside swings in CapEx, they're sort of taking those off the table because there's a certain baseline of money that has to get spent. Even if you're not adding any new wafer capacity, that sort of baseline dollar that has to get spent is now much higher than it actually used to be. So it's actually taking that sort of big downside case off the table. So when you think of manufacturing and you think of how you plan that, does that change how you think about planning your manufacturing, particularly in light of the merger with Tel? You know, you have Austin, you have Singapore. Does it change how you think about that? Do you need to maybe plan for a little more sustained business?
Yeah, that's a good question. So when I walked into Worldwide Ops Manufacturing, which I work with too, the goals tended to be around specific manufacturing goals. I said, well, I want to understand how the manufacturing goals tie to the company goal, right? So if you go look at the company goal, it's really to gain market share and grow the business, right? Because that's a lot of profit in that. So how does manufacturing help the company and Worldwide Ops in the supply chain strategy fit that? It's time to market. So in other words, if you get high quality differentiated products to market and gain market share, you'll make a lot of money. So in terms of laying out the single biggest, you guys would be, so if I asked you all what's the single biggest financial indicator for me, you'd come up with a whole bunch of them. ASPs, gross margin, operating margins, tax rate. That's not my single biggest financial indicator. My single biggest financial indicator is velocity, speed, right? Because if we rapidly move money from low returns to high returns, if we rapidly execute product development, if we rapidly execute manufacturing, if we rapidly execute ramping tools in the field, if we quickly move expense money from underperforming areas to overperforming, we'll make a lot of money, okay? Speed is the single biggest financial indicator for me in technology companies, right? So what's the point? In your strategy, you want to go to a low fixed cost, high flexible model in OPEX, in manufacturing, in your responsiveness. So in terms of this, if we go to that model, regardless of whether the environment is $25 or $37 billion, we'll make a lot of money, right? Because it's a high flexibility, high speed model. We'll gain share, we'll make a lot of money. So in terms of your thing, I'm focused on keeping fixed costs down, including taxes. I'm interested in moving faster. So if you think of manufacturing, we moved a pilot manufacturing facility back into California, which we hadn't had one. We were in Austin, Singapore, because speed, time to market, is critical to growing the business, revenue, market share. So flexibility, speed, low fixed costs, that's a good model for our industry.
Do we have any audience questions?
We pay for questions.
Maybe we can talk about a couple of products. First of all, the silicon business. Silicon margins are running mid 100 basis points below where they ran at similar revenue levels 2 to 2.5 years ago. A, what is the cause? And B, do you think you can get back to prior SSG margin levels?
Yeah, so we have multiple businesses in the company. We have a semi-equipment business, we have a solar equipment business, a display equipment business, and a services business we called Apply Global Services, AGS, and that has the service component for all three of the above, semi, solar, and display. Most of that's semi-related. So if you look in the semi-equipment business, our operating margins down somewhat from the peak of several years ago. A lot of that is intentional. We've invested more heavily in product development in SSG. The whole company is about 4 points higher in R&D as percentage of sales than similar revenue levels. SSG specifically is probably more like 5 or 6 points. And we're not getting any revenues from those, right? We're investing to get revenues. So if you look at this past year, in 2013 calendar, we actually gained share in wafer fab equipment. We gained share in all of our addressable markets except CVD. So we gained share virtually everywhere. We hadn't done that in years. But we didn't do it with the benefit of the new products. We're funding the new products, which will help us in 2015, right? Or late 2015, maybe. Depends when they cut in. And so we intentionally took a haircut on SSG margins to invest in growth. And we were able to increase the operating margins of the rest of the company by focus on everything else. Overhead structure, SG&A, solar business, display business, service business. But we believe the operating margins of the SSG business will be very comparable in a couple of years to what we achieved near the peak.
So you can get back to your prior margin?
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay. I also wanted to ask about AGS, the service business. If you comp it to any of the other companies, the service business continues to underperform, which is not news. But what is the issue? The margins are actually pretty good, but the revenue is not growing as fast as it ought to be. And A, what is the issue? And B, how are you changing the structure of that group to fix that problem?
Yeah, there's probably a few issues. One, process equipment is a little different than inspection equipment, which is KLA, and lithography equipment, which is ASML. Those guys have a little bit more captive audience than service. But that said, our opportunity is big in service, particularly with Tokyo Electron, and we can do better. So I don't dispute anything you can. There's a big opportunity here. If you look at it, we probably capture a little under 40% of our addressable market in service. Tokyo Electron's probably under 20%, my guess, right? So it's a big opportunity, and we will do better. So now you say, well, why aren't you doing better? A couple of reasons. One, if you go look at the service business, like your marketing classes in college, right, it's you segment markets three ways. You look at high value, high performance, low cost competitive, and middle of the road. So most of our business is high performance or cost competitive. So in the high performance, we do very well. We get high share on differentiated products and services that they don't have a lot of options to us. But in the cost competitive stuff, we need some better cost structures. So we can do that. We can do that by sourcing more stuff in low cost regions and stuff. So we'll keep share, keep the gross margins, and increase our revenues because we'll keep the share. So we can do that in the low cost competitive stuff. The second issue is, we can work more closely between the companies, because when SSG, the equipment guys, develop new products, by working more closely with the AGS guys, they can enable the service business more fully for the next 10 years. So what we did this year, fiscal 14, 20% of the bonus plan for the executives in SSG is based on AGS service performance and growth in that business revenues. And that was the first time we've done that in years. So tighter collaboration and enablement between the equipment business and the service business will drive performance. And then fourthly, we incrementally changed and added to the management in the AGS business. So we think it's a big opportunity. We have a big opportunity. We need to do better. We will do better. And we made some substantive changes there.
Just last product-related question for me, and then we have time for probably one question from the audience. But you had said you've been very consistent saying that EES is not a business that you have a particular passion about. Which we've all, I think, read to mean that you'll sort of take it or leave it. So can you talk about, given that the business is now slightly profitable this year and, you know, you've done a great job taking out costs, but yet business is actually getting a bit better, still probably limited in terms of how good that it can be, but it's getting a bit better. Does it make you change your approach to EES? Are you still dispassionate about it?
Yeah, I think it's like everything we do. You do an environmental assessment, and you say, how's the market? And it's pretty objective, right? So we believe the semi and display markets have higher opportunity for revenues and higher growth rate. Now, solar has gotten better. If you talked to us a year, year and a half ago, you would have said, gee whiz, what are you doing with solar? It's losing a lot of money. What's going on? Everyone would have been beating me up in the hallways here. What we did was we turned it from, I don't know, $150 million loss, big write-offs, to actually making a little money. And we were very opportunistic. We sold the inventory, we managed expenses down, so now it's kind of a neutral. Now, we're very opportunistic in that we actually have a couple of new products coming out there, and probably we can grow it some. But the inherent problem is it's not a big market, and it's probably not going to grow too much for a year or two. So we're okay either way. We're very dispassionate on this one. If the business does okay, fine. If the business doesn't do okay, we won't let that happen, right? We're pretty dispassionate.
We have time for one more question from the audience. I know there's a good one out there.
The person with the microphone keeps standing up, and I think he has a question. Is there one over here? No.
Any more questions? Well, thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Thank you for the time. Appreciate it.
Thanks.